This time on the Plutopia podcast, Joseph Rowe joins John and Scoop from Paris. In this episode, we discuss controversial COVID therapies in France, morality, and spiritual evolution.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. And our guest today is a return guest, Joseph Rowe, a close friend of mine who's a musician, a composer, a writer, and a storyteller. He's an author and translator, a meditator and teacher, and he performs sacred music and conducts workshops with Catherine Breslavsky and lives in Paris, France. How are things in Paris, Joseph?
The general, of course, the answer is in relation to the, of course, to the general pandemic situation. France started off better than the U.S., but now that Trump is gone, I wouldn't say it's that much better. It's been very mismanaged here, and I don't suffer that much from it. I'm lucky to have a lifestyle which isn't some people, for example, are directly or indirectly very dependent on either performance or on things like restaurants being open, theaters being open, that kind of thing. They're having a very hard time. And young people are especially having a hard time. And I think it's, quite frankly, in all countries, this applies to all countries, it's just outrageous to make young people pay this high price for essentially protecting their elders who need more protection than they do. And this situation would never, of course, this is hindsight, but this situation, without getting into any conspiratorial stuff and everything, just Big Pharma has dictated the parameters of the conversation. Vaccines are the panacea. And from the very beginning, there's been a disinclination and even a forbidding, and here in France, of use of therapies that definitely work very well with some COVID patients. I've seen interviews with doctors. These are not conspiracy theorists. They're very reputable, very creative doctors who had found several substances that worked very well with some COVID patients, not all.
What substances are you referring to?
My memory is not very good for this. Hydrochloroquine, something like that. That's pretty well known, right?
That
works very well. That works incredibly well with patients, provided that they get enough zinc with it. That wasn't even noticed in a lot of so-called failures of hydrochloroquine. People don't get enough zinc. It has to have good quantity of zinc in order to work. And it doesn't work all the time, but it works on some. There's another substance, and I forget the name of it. It's an antibiotic, and it works also with some and not with others. There's an array of these treatments that, used in a really medically competent and common sense way, would probably have reduced by half the hospitalizations.
Well, hydroxychloroquine has been given to patients, but is associated with severe heart rhythm problems, and that's one of the reasons that they have chosen not to use it.
Those are side effects. All things have side effects, yeah.
Right, exactly.
That's quite frankly,
and there isn't very good support for the idea that hydroxychloroquine is that helpful with.
I disagree totally. Here in France, one of the greatest immunologists in France. Again, I forgot his name. He's a long haired. He's very famous, and he has been prevented. He said by
neither one of us is a pharmacologist or a physician, so I guess we probably shouldn't be the ones to
be. I would say, John, that I'm privy to points of view that you're not. You haven't been listening to. And I understand why you... I think I understand this vaccine reveal series. It's called VR, Vaccines Revealed. I think there's a... I think I can understand why you would not want to listen to that series, is because it does have one huge flaw. The guy who organized it, a guy named Gentempo, who's a chiropractor, brought together, and this shows you a kind of manipulation that's very common in our times. He brought together a very large number of doctors of various kinds, some of whom, namely Dr. Zach Bush, who is one of my heroes. I use his treatments, in fact. But some of whom, like Dr. Zach Bush, are really excellent and very intelligent, very sound, I should say, challengers of the big pharma line. Others that he brought together are not at all as credible, and still others are quite frankly quacks. And you have this huge, range of people in this series. And the really shameful thing is that he deliberately gives the impression that these people have all talked to each other and all pretty much agree with each other. They don't. They don't even know about each other a lot of times. They've just been all right. But you see the danger of that kind of manipulation.
Well, one of the problems that you have, I think, with science in general is that it takes time for, I mean, scientific method is not like a quick way to come to a determination or decision, because you have to take time to examine hypotheses and test hypotheses, and the testing itself can be problematic if you don't structure tests correctly. So you do have some tests that show that a thing is effective and others that show that it's not effective. And how do you decide in that case whether you make a determination that it's effective? And I'm thinking about hydroxychloroquine. I think there are tests that show that, or there have been studies that show that it was effective against COVID, studies that show that it's not. Concern about side effects. There's a whole hash of things that people are concerned about. And, you know, without going over the edge with hydroxychloroquine in particular, I think it's a knowledge problem, really. And we're more aware of it now than ever, because there has been a sort of almost like a war of perspectives and a war of bases for knowledge that are contradictory in the conflict. And unfortunately, one of the victims of this war has been independent and fairly objective inquiry. People are drawn into biased perspectives so easily and readily that it's very hard to know whether you can trust an information source or something that you hear or something that was written. And so much of what we hear today, especially through our various internet channels, is just a collection of opinions that people are throwing around. And I think I think you and I can both agree that that's really the problem.
Yeah, I think it's a problem with roots that go back to what I call postmodern madness. extreme delusions of postmodernism I'll give you an example of postmodern. It's very aligned with political correctness, and especially on the left, not just on the right, and also on the right sometimes, very often. Well, it's caused a right reaction that's much worse than what it's reacting against. But at any rate, here's an example of what I call postmodern madness. In France, some years ago, I just had a terrible thought that maybe I've talked about this before.
I don't think so.
Did I talk about this African woman in relation to clitorectomy?
I don't think you talked about that on our previous discussion.
Yeah, okay, you remember that with that. If I talked about clitorectomy before, you probably wouldn't forget it. Okay.
Sounds painful.
Not only is it painful, it's despicable, and it's wrong. At any rate, that's a very non-postmodern statement. This woman, African woman, who comes from a culture which practices clitorectomy, and whose daughter, whose granddaughter, however, or maybe it was her niece, I think it was her niece, was born in France, is a French citizen, and of course, clitorectomy totally illegal here. She took her back to Senegal or wherever it was to have a clitorectomy. And when she came back here, she was prosecuted and thrown in prison for a long prison spell. In her defense, all these leftist postmodernists came in to say, how can we judge another culture like that? And I say, we can judge another culture. It's not all relative. Cannibalism, we've gotten beyond that, you know. It's not just we've gotten beyond a lot of things, believe it or not. I know it's hard to believe. Sometimes it seems like there's no moral progress at all in human evolution, but there is some. And clitorectomy is an example of an unenlightened, inhuman, destructive practice that should be a crime everywhere.
Well, what you would call genital mutilation.
Yeah.
And there's other forms of that, too. But some people would say that circumcision is genital mutilation, but we still practice it in this country.
That's not the same thing. Not at all the same thing. Circumcision doesn't decrease sexual pleasure. In fact, it increases it, according to some accounts. The arguments against circumcision are pretty weak, and there's a lot of back and forth on both sides, whereas the arguments against clitorectomy are quite decisive. You know, there's no comparison.
This also makes me think about, this was just yesterday, there was an exchange where Rand Paul, the senator, was questioning Dr. Rachel Levine, who I think was an appointment that is, you know, where they're seeking confirmation. I can't remember exactly what she had been, what her appointment was to. I think assistant secretary at Health and Human Services. And the exchange was about gender transition. And Rand Paul was questioning the aspect of gender transition that includes what he was referring to as genital mutilation, which is sort of an inherent part of a complete gender transition.
Well, it's a very pejorative term, of course.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, so normally you might say castration, but in the context of gender transition, it's just part of a process that the patient and the doctor find reasonable.
Yeah, so no problem with that. That's pretty obvious.
So what is...
The girl doesn't choose. The point is, the girl doesn't choose. It'd be one thing if women chose clitorectomy when they become of age, or if even maybe a certain age girls, 18, choose it. That would be a different thing, but they don't. It shows it's imposed on them. That's the point.
And the whole idea was to leave sexual pleasure to the men only and prevent women from being...
Right.
Sex slaves was one way they would explain it, that they were, would become slaves to sex, so they were removing the temptation.
That is the purpose of it. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me to be a really horrible thing, and it seems like it really exists for that, you know, that it's... what is it, a sort of misogynistic, culturally misogynistic approach? But kind of my question was, what rationale do they think they have for doing it?
I don't think that matters so much. I don't think it's that interesting. We could go into that, but point
well, but
is,
you were talking about the postmodern criticism.
Yeah,
if there can't that be, was based on
relative. It's a deeper delusion that everything is relative. This mindless cultural relativism, which goes far beyond just respect for other cultures and putting yourself in their place and, trying to help them into a more enlightened view of things. It's not at all that. It's taking a stance of moral relativism, saying that really there aren't any overarching values. And of course, the obvious stupidity in that postmodern point of view is that they are objectively saying there's no objectivity. You get the point? It's a self-contradiction. Yeah. It's just, you say, how do you know? How do you know that everything is relative? How do you know that? You see?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question about whether there is an absolute morality. And if there is, who determines what the rules are? I mean, who determines that absolute morality is?
You don't have to have anyone. You don't have to have anyone determine what the rules are. And you don't have to have moral principles, absolute moral principles either. What is absolute is, if the term, kind of an overly strong term, what is non-relative at any rate, is moral perception, not moral principles. And sometimes moral perception can violate previous moral principles. I'll give you a good example of that. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Murder. He murdered his best friend. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And yes. That was an ethical act, if you remember. How could any person with true moral perception disagree that that was a noble, a brave, and an ethical act to murder his best friend and be willing to accept murder charges himself and have to escape? Because he did it.
But it seems to me that in any kind of morality, somebody has to, there has to be some description or assertion of what that morality is.
Well, that has to be.
And you seem to be saying that you should just know automatically what it is.
No. So it can only be temporary. Moral principles are temporarily necessary, but it's true that moral principles can change because moral perception can be deepened, just as it was in the case of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Because of a deeper moral perception, you saw that there's a limitation to this, the thing murder is wrong. It doesn't apply to all cases, and he found one. And... there's a great, I think it's all beautifully explained in a very non-postmodern piece of wisdom, the Tao Te Ching, which says, if I recall, something like this. When the Tao is lost, morality becomes necessary. When morality is lost, laws become necessary. So there is a kind of relativism inherent about the morality, because already people have lost touch with the Tao. In order to, otherwise, they wouldn't even need moral principles. However, there is no, that relativity does not apply to the Tao itself. And that's where postmodernism is actually nihilistic and just wrong.
Well, I mean, what I learned from, I actually had a very good ethics class at one time taught by a guy named William Penn, Bill Penn. And that was at St. Edward's University. And what I learned about ethics and morality in that class was that it was not so much about what a specific like decision is, so much more the basis for the decision and the level of moral reasoning that supports whatever choice it is that you make. And that some people are very shallow, morally shallow, and that they don't have a very high level of ethical perception.
Yeah.
So, and of course, given that, they could be ethically compromised. But that it's not so much that you have any set rules, but that you have a level of judgment and a level of moral perception that guides you in making the right kind of decision.
The key word is perception there. And that can't be captured by any frozen formulation. And that's, I call it the Tao, you know, he calls it, I think what he's calling a level of moral perception and reasoning, I call a connection with the Tao. But I think we're talking about the same thing.
But it seems that you're saying, on the one hand, that there is an moral absolute, but on the other hand, that there are no moral absolutes, that it's a matter of moral perception.
Or the absolute.
Of understanding.
It's in the Tao. The absolute is only found in the Tao, and it can't be formulated. Once it's formulated, it's no longer absolute.
Yeah, I'm lost there. I really don't. It seems to me that an understanding of an absolute morality, you would have to have some formulation of that reality.
Well, sometimes the formulations are in accord, but that can only happen in particular instances. It can't be abstract. You don't know if it's always going to work. That, for example, in this instance, and we're talking about a living instance, that's where these things are tested. That's the only way they can be tested, the principles, you know, the formulations. In this instance of this woman taking this girl to be mutilated in Senegal, it's obviously out of, not only out of touch with the law, it's out of touch with, and out of touch with moral principles, it's out of touch with the Tao. It's wrong. It's totally wrong. It's absolutely and relatively wrong. But some people don't want to, you know, they're afraid to, they want to, I don't know what the motivation behind postmodernism is.
Joseph, let me pose another situation.
Okay.
My ancestry from both sides of my family is Native American, Cherokee and Choctaw. And when the white man came from Europe to the United States, well, it wasn't called that then, they saw these, as they call them, Indians, practicing their own native religion or their native spirituality, really. And it was more earth-based. They believed in a creator, but it was the wrong one, according to the people from Europe. So they began to kill them because they wouldn't convert. Well, our my mother's nation, the Choctaw Nation, was moved to Oklahoma and told that they had to convert. So they'd been seeing, they'd already lost half of their people to the Europeans. So they converted to Christianity, not because of a belief change, but because they knew they had to do it to survive. Now, where's the moral certainty in a situation like that? Who's right? Who's wrong?
Oh, that's a pretty easy one, yeah. Obviously, it's a totally immoral situation. I'm sure you see that.
Yes. But there are many among us who would see it as the great Western and expansion, and it just had to be done because Christianity was right and the Indians were wrong.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. Those people are morally mistaken, that's all. They're mistaken on both on the level of the Tao and on the level of principles. Yeah, it's just wrong. It's wrong to treat people like that.
Trying to explain that to people who firmly believe there is only one true way, that's something that's used by many cultures, usually for the wrong reasons. It's hard to try and convince these people there's one true way, but it may not be the one that you like, or it may be that all these ways have a truth to them.
Yeah, maybe we could put it this way. The good news is there is an absolute. There is an absolute moral sense. The bad news is you can never formulate it. But to say there's not one, and as you know that there's not one, that's taking a step way too far. And it has given rise to mindless relativism, to enter this epistemological crisis that we are in today, in my opinion. It's that postmodernist legacy of Hitler just was doing what he thought was right, that sort of thing. Someone told me that once. I can't judge Hitler. I said, you say you can't judge Hitler. In a sense, maybe I could agree with you. You're talking about some essence there. But what about his actions? Certainly you can judge those. No, I can't even judge those. Wait a minute. Okay. You've lost it, You've lost it. You've lost your connection with the Tao. One thing to say, that there's an essence of someone that's always well-intentioned. That's a kind of a strange thing. I wouldn't argue with that. I'm not so sure I'd want to put things that way. But I wouldn't argue with it, though. I heard someone say once, all beings are well-intentioned, fundamentally. And I personally wouldn't argue with that. I think that's kind of groping towards, in a very poorly stated way, it's groping towards something about affirming the Tao. But the Tao which can be spoken is not the Tao,
Well, we recently had this assault on the Capitol here and an insurrectionist movement here in the U.S. And many people deplore what happened there, but there were people who participated in that insurrection who felt that what they were doing was absolutely what needed to be done and was the right thing for America.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, I think that gets back to what I was saying about a matter of perspective. You can get a perspective where you will believe that something is the right thing.
But that is just how, don't you see, Joe, what I'm saying is the desire to combat that kind of stupid absolutism and morally wrong absolutism by denying all absolute truth of any kind is catastrophic. And it has created the mess we're in today of conspiracy theories everywhere. Nobody, of people thinking they have to react to everything. There's people having no tolerance of just, I don't know, you know. I don't know. Let's see.
Well, I mean, it sounds like kind of a wicked problem to me. I mean, how does a person who, it's sort of like, how does a person know what they don't know? You know, how is a person to understand that their perspective is wrong if they're completely committed to that perspective?
Well, it needs time.
One way you do it is as a society, you set laws, as we said, or you take positions as a society, but even that is based on some perception of what is considered right versus what is considered wrong. So what if a society decided that in some cases it's really fine to murder somebody? And it becomes law, and it becomes that society is committed to that position that if somebody does some prescribed thing to you that, and you choose to murder them, that's really perfectly okay. I mean, in a way, we kind of have that. We say in self-defense, you can kill somebody in self-defense. So say, well, it's really okay to kill somebody if they, you know, if they run a red light. And that makes it okay to kill somebody. Does that make it more or less wrong?
I don't see any problem with that, Joe. Where's the problem with that? It's just there are bad laws, there are good laws, and there are laws which have to be changed. And no law is ever going to capture the Tao, because don't you see what that says? I repeat it. When the Tao is lost, morals become necessary. When morals are lost, the law becomes necessary.
Well, okay, so how do you get everybody committed to the Tao?
Oh, that's a different...
I'm trying to get an understanding of what you're actually arguing for, because it's not clear to me exactly what you're looking for. What are you looking for, a solution?
I thought I said it clearly. Postmodernists, in order to have made the fundamental error that in order to combat absolutist types of tyranny, they have to deny the very existence of any absolute truth. And that's wrong. It's a mistake. If they had said, we deny the existence of any formulation of absolute truth, but we don't deny absolute truth itself, then that would have been not so bad. That would have been something I maybe could go along with. But they have absolutely, in their own absolutism, they have denied the existence of any kind of connection with the absolute.
You mean you're saying that they're being absolute about things not being absolute?
Yeah, exactly.
I just associated postmodernism with a kind of radical skepticism, you know.
Well, it's that too.
Skeptical of absolutes. And it's, you know,
unfortunately, it's gone way beyond that. If they just stopped with that, the skepticism about absolutes, that would be okay. And they could go further and maybe get a sense of what the Tao Te Ching has been telling people for millennia. But
I mean, it seems like one extension of your argument would be an argument against multiculturalism, right? Saying that.
No.
Cultural differentiation is not something that should occur because we have some absolute morality that we follow, and if a culture is to vary from that morality,
not at all. No culture can ever. But remember, the Tao can be spoken is not the Tao. And if one culture can never be a complete expression of the Tao, another very different culture will be a different expression of the Tao. Perhaps. Yeah, it's quite possible. So it's not monoculturalism at all.
You know, you had wanted to talk about spiritual evolution. And what I actually intended to lead with, and we've sort of gone off on a different track, was a question about how you define spiritual or spirit. What is spiritual?
That's a good question. What is it to you? And to you, Scoop, what does that mean, word mean to you, spiritual? Say spiritual, but not religious, as people say nowadays. Hmm. What does that mean? Spiritual, but not religious, but not necessarily religious.
Well, when I started thinking about this, actually, I thought about this a lot this morning, and I realized that I'm really not sure what, I don't really have a clear concept of the spiritual. I've used the word a lot, and I realize that I've used it in a way that's kind of shoddy, in that I really didn't have a strong sense of what I was representing when I used the word. You know, it's sort of like it's a word that stands for things that are beyond us in some way, that transcend the human. But I'm not even sure, you know, that spiritual reality actually exists. Scoop, you were about to answer, too, so I'll shut up.
Yeah, spirituality, I always felt was a bit like the cliche, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and it's the same thing with spirituality. It boils down to a personal thing, you know, what do you experience that transcends your physical being? Do you have anything that transcends that? Now look at that as spirituality. In the Native American spiritual community, they believe in many of the nations believe in a creator of some sort, but it's not Christian type creator. It is more of a natural order of things. Most of the spirituality is earth based and nature based. You worship. If you kill an animal to eat them, you thank them for their sacrifice, which has always kind of creeped me out a bit. But it's more of just a personal belief. You know, what about you transcends your physical being?
You mentioned the beautiful. There's also the good and the true. Those are the classic three aspects of what you might say of the spiritual value, which, according to Plato, are one. And I think we can all agree with that, right? That the good, the true, and the beautiful are different aspects of one supreme value. Right? Am I right?
Yes, but what I consider beautiful may not be beautiful to you. So once again, it's a personal evaluation of what is true, what is beauty, what is spiritual.
Yeah, that kind of might seem to get back into relativism again. You might say there's an irreducible relativism, but it's not an absolute relativism. like the postmodernist stuff. But it's an irreducible, I think you're kind of referring to that, is that our language, all human languages are based on the separation of subject and object. And that is such a huge limitation that we can't really, there's a limit to what we can tell each other, what we can communicate. There is a beauty, it could be that there's a beauty that I perceive that I simply cannot tell you. I cannot communicate how I perceive that to you. It's not that it's, I have one and you have the other. That's not true. I don't believe that. I don't have to believe that in order to acknowledge that I simply can't communicate it.
Isn't beauty very subjective?
I don't think it has to be. I don't think we have to decide that.
But what I consider beautiful, you might not consider beautiful.
Well, but like, again, that's just because you can't communicate to me. You're unable to communicate to me. Inherently, you'll never be able to communicate to me the full experience of that beauty.
But isn't that inherently something that is a subjective experience?
Well, there are talking to each other is not the only form of communication. There are, I'm sure you've experienced this, it's unfortunately rare in human life, but we've all had experiences of communion where this problem completely disappears. And we know we're experiencing the same truth, the same beauty. We don't, that problem is gone.
I'm thinking about that.
But this is, again, this is getting into things. This is why the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao, because this kind of communion resists any kind of formulation in words. Concepts.
So, you were going to talk about spiritual evolution. And I know you sent me some things and you had some specific things you wanted to talk about. Do you want to get into that?
I wish I could point you to my article about it. Which I call oh my gosh, I'm looking for it now because I forgot it. The hidden evolution debate, the overlooked evolution debate, briefly speaking, the evolution debate most of us have been seeing for the last several decades now is, to me, it reminds me of two rams in a head-butting contest and probably causing brain damage to each other. One of those rams is a scientific materialist, a neo-Darwinist, Richard Dawkins being the prime example, the most illustrious example, who would have us believe that random mutation of genes plus survival of the fittest, and survival of the fittest, those three things are enough to explain the amazing variety, complexity, ingenuity, and adaptation of living forms, you know. And then on the other side, the other ram butting its head is the creationist, who says he doesn't just say there's intelligent design. He says there's an intelligent designer. And in fact, these two Rands butting each other actually agree on that point, that if there's intelligent design, there has to be an intelligent designer. Right?
Yeah.
But that's wrong. That's an obvious logical mistake. Any Buddhist will tell you that it's a fundamental mistake. You know, the main difference between Buddhism and all the Abrahamic religions and, is that Buddhists don't accept a creator God. It's not that they don't believe in God. It's they don't accept an outside standard. They don't accept a self of any kind, whether it's divine, human, or anything, that stands outside of all creation. Everything is interdependent, and the only being is interbeing. Nothing has any being except in relation to the whole. So, a Buddhist.
But that's not the same as a belief in a God, right?
Exactly. No, it's not at all.
I mean, you were saying that.
What?
That they may believe in God, but not in the Creator God. But
no, they
really.
What I mean is, they might believe in a meaning to the word God that doesn't, if it doesn't imply a Creator, an all Creator. At any rate, that's the side. That's not very important. That's just kind of, they would be bending over backwards to try to give some meaning to God, but. The Buddhists would say, would answer both the neo-Darwinists and the creationists. But they would say, wait a minute. Why can't there be intelligence and intelligent design without a designer? And that's getting to the evolution debate. That's just barely beginning to get into the evolution debate that's been overlooked.
Well, I think that to some extent we really strain to try to understand what all of this means and why are we here, where are we going, and all of these things that you're talking about. Pretty much everything that we've talked about is just stuff that comes out of the imagination. How do we really know? Well, we don't really know what's true. And we certainly don't know why the universe is as it is or why things seem so perfectly well designed. How can we answer that question?
Well, again, you know, just going back to the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. There is an access to something. One of my teachers called it a third form of knowing. That was his. That is beyond conceptual knowledge for sure, and beyond perceptual knowledge also. And it's also been called gnosis. What that is, what he called it, Dr. Franklin Merrill Wolf was his name. I'll put that in the chat before I go. I'll put a link to that. He had the following phrase, knowledge through identity. That is a powerful phrase. That is a very powerful phrase. It's radically different from any other kind of knowledge that we are familiar with. And yet all the mystics are familiar with it.
And what does it mean?
Well, you don't quite. You have. Doesn't that suggest anything that you have experienced?
Well, I'm thinking pretty hard about it. I sort of don't put those two things together, knowledge and identity. I may identify with certain things or certain people or certain aspects of my environment, but how does that relate to knowledge?
Well, identifying with something, it's not knowledge by identification with something. That's not what it is. It's knowledge through identity. And
you mean knowledge by identifying something? You identify something and therefore you know it?
No, it's not that. Not that at all. It's kind of like the knowledge that so-called primitive peoples are very familiar with. Like American Indians, for example, Africans, where, for example, in this African boy's story of his initiation, a wonderful book called Of Water and the Spirit by Male Doma Somme, he describes his initiation. And this boy was told to go sit by a tree until he really knows the tree. That's all. And to make a long story short, what finally happened to this boy was that he became the tree. He disappeared. All sense of separation between him and tree disappeared. He was the tree. That's knowledge through identity.
Is that in the sense of dropping body and mind and becoming one with interbeing?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a mystical kind of knowledge. Some people call it Gnostic. I think it's a great discovery that Dr. Wolf made of a, not a discovery in the sense of something new, but a discovery in the sense of a reformulation, very useful formulation to get us beyond this relativism of ordinary knowledge, that there's a third kind of knowledge that's neither perceptual nor conceptual.
I'm meditating.
Yeah, maybe that's certainly as a conversation stopper.
It is indeed. So like that thing I asked the other day, what is mind? We kind of think we know what our mind isn't, but we think about it.
I used to practice, my very first Zen practice many years ago was a koan, and it's a little known koan, but it was a very, very powerful one for me. It was, what is this mind? You just ask yourself that over and over. You stop. Nothing. You just always come back to, what is this mind? What is this mind? And it's incredibly powerful. I was too young, actually, when I first drove me crazy, but I recovered somehow.
I find myself, as I grow older, becoming very skeptical of pretty much everything. And it's because
skeptical,
it's all
of
just
what? Sorry?
Pretty much everything, you know. I'm not even sure that what I see is what I'm seeing, or that what I hear is what I'm hearing. And certainly I'm not sure that what I'm reading has any connection with reality.
I find myself being skeptical of skepticism, so there you go.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yes. Your skepticism must include skepticism, because otherwise it's a very tail-chasing skepticism that just nothing but just goes in circles of samsara. the kind of skepticism I think Scoop is alluding to is a really profound not knowing. It's that it's the same as that exercise we do in meditation sometimes of not knowing, just not knowing anything.
Well, and the way that some people deal with their skepticism is through adoption of faith, accepting something with faith, because they can't really affirm it through their perception or through their experience.
Well, by faith, you mean something deeper than belief?
I think that faith is probably a little deeper than belief, yeah. I mean, you can believe something, but if you actually have faith in something, it's not just believing, but committing to that belief.
I would say it's even deeper than committing. Committing to a belief is easy for fanatics to do that all the time. But it's deeper than commitment. I'd say it's radically deeper than belief. It's true faith is not needing to know. It's kind of, or you might say it's knowledge through identity. Yeah, knowledge through identity. You can't really formulate completely that true faith.
Well, you can believe, for instance, that Jesus existed and that he, that his words have been captured, and you can believe what you read about him. But I think it takes a real act of faith to accept that he is your pathway to salvation. I think that goes deeper than just believing.
Well, I think you got to separate two things in that particular thing. Example of Jesus. The stories about Jesus are totally separate from Jesus' teaching Jesus' example. You don't have to believe in those stories at all to have faith that kind of really profound faith. You don't have to believe in that a historical event happened. That's a belief. You'll always, if you're talking about a historical event, it's always going to be in the realm of belief.
Well, I mean, pretty much everything that we see, hear, feel, experience is subject to belief, because it's really reconstruction, perceptual. I mean, our perceptions, things come in through our perceptual devices, and our brain constructs a reality from those things, right?
Yeah,
you never have a direct experience of reality.
Yeah, mediated. I don't know. I don't know. Could be.
Or do you?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know. How far does belief go? Does it go as far as some people say? It creates reality, this reality. Even this reality we're in here now is just simply a product of belief on some deep level involving lots of beings, I suppose. Could be, I don't know.
I think we have reached the end of our hour. And rightly so. I think we're also at the end of our tether.
I'm going to go do some head scratching now. Maybe next time we have you back, we can discuss which came first, the chicken or the egg, and really confuse people.
Which came first, the bacon or the egg?
Pancakes, I think, perhaps.
Well, maybe next time I'll manage to talk about something that's not a conversation stopper.
I don't know. I kind of don't mind the conversation stoppers. I think that
me neither, really, to tell you the truth.
We definitely have a lot to think about from our conversation today.
I mean, you know, you and I, all of us, I guess, from a kind of spiritual standpoint, have the disadvantage, at least a lot of people would see it this way, I see it this way, have the disadvantage of loving to think. I love to think, it's true, I do love to think. But that is kind of like saying you love whiskey, you know?
Yeah. An addiction. You're addicted to thinking.
Yeah.
Can't quite put it aside. It's an opiate. Well, thanks, Joseph.
Okay, well, thank you.
Great conversation, and we'll do this again.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.